Next year's budget is set to be a major shift in how the government sets indicators and measures how well it is performing. The wellbeing budget will cover five priorities: mental health, child poverty, lifting Māori and Pacific opportunities, and a focus on the digital age and a low emissions economy. Law passed this month means future ministers of finance are now required by legislation to report on the impact their administrations are having on indicators such as child poverty. The National Party leader, Simon Bridges, says he doesn't see how, quote, a bunch of 100 fluffy wellbeing indicators will improve New Zealanders' lives. So we've asked an economist. Augusto Lopez Claros is on leave from the World Bank, where he is the director of the Global Indicators Group, and he's currently on a fellowship with Georgetown University. He is a former chief economist at the World Economic Forum, and I spoke to him on his visit to New Zealand last week. He's previously said that increasing market activity had been directly responsible for declines in well-being. I asked him to explain.
There's sort of a debate among economists and social scientists about the need for a kind of a clearer mental demarcation between the concept of growth, economic growth, and economic development. In many people's minds, you know, sometimes these concepts are interchangeable, but I don't think that's the proper way to look at it. The first concept, which is economic growth, I think has essentially to do with the expansion of the scale of the economic system. It's a quantitative concept. Whereas the concept of development, I think, refers to qualitative changes in the system and in its relationship with the environment and other aspects of life in the community. And I think that the proper way to understand economics should be to concern itself less with how to add to the physical dimension of the economic system and more with the long-term welfare of the community whose interest the system is ultimately intended to serve. And it seems to me that this distinction is really quite fundamental, especially in recent decades, given what we have learned about, for instance, the likely impact of climate change and associated environmental disasters that are coming our way.
Merely a few decades ago, that idea of economics, as you've just described it, would have been seen as probably a kind of madness or certainly incorrect. What changed? What have been the main drivers of change?
I think that one of the drivers of change has been sort of increasing dissatisfaction with the metric that we have been using to capture, you know, welfare, the gross national product, GNP, this figure that our politicians tend to obsess about.
And we tend to use GDP more commonly in New Zealand, but listeners will probably be familiar with GNP as well. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about GDP then. There is overwhelming evidence that any income accounting system, to give you an example, that treats the depletion of natural resources as current income and thus as a positive contribution to the growth of GNP is a metric that obviously provides, you know, perverse incentives. And so I think that people have realized that you can have GDP growing quickly and at the same time have a number of processes in the economy at large which are actually not particularly desirable. Environmental devastation, pollution, you know, when as a result of the pollution and problems in the environment, you know, we have to spend more money on health to compensate for the effects of pollution, this actually contributes to an increase in the GDP. And more generally, there is sort of a dissatisfaction with the sense that our focus on GDP has led to a kind of a false dichotomy in many countries, you know, where protection of natural resources and the environment is very often perceived as being a constraint on economic growth rather than as a means of safeguarding its sustainability. And so this has then led to a discussion about, you know, are there better metrics? Is there a better way to capture welfare? And I want to give you an example from some very interesting work that was done, already 20 years ago in the 1990s. And there was an economist at the World Bank by the name of Hermine Daly who put together something that at the time was called an Index of Sustainable Economic Welfare, which was his attempt to develop a metric that would capture growth, but would incorporate in the definition of the metric such factors as long-term environmental damage, depletion of non-renewable resources, the costs of pollution, and, other kind of welfare-destroying phenomena. And what they did, is they went back to 1966 for the U.S. economy, and Bailey and his partner, John Cobb. And what they demonstrated that in the United States, inflation-adjusted income per capita using this index was actually 4% lower in 1990 than it had been in 1966. Now, the interesting part of this experiment was that conventionally measured GDP per capita rose by 55% over the same period, right? And so this, I think, highlighted in a very eloquent way, some of the limitations that sometimes are implicit in the use of an indicator that doesn't really capture many of these undesirable trends, especially on the environment.
Has anyone used that framework successfully to cost policy since it was developed?
No, I was very, very impressed with this work. I think it was sound work from a technical perspective, but essentially, although there has been a sort of a, I don't want to say universal recognition, but certainly a sort of increasing recognition in the profession and among policymakers that our current metric does not capture effectively human welfare, there has been no serious attempt to actually replace it by something that would be, more sensible, something like the work done by Herman Daly and John Cobb in the 1990s, although there are other candidates as well. We seem to be fixated on GDP. Our political systems move up and down depending on what happens to this metric. Governments fall. Politicians highlight during their campaigns for office, whether under their tenure this metric went up and so on. And I think that the issue is no longer technical. I think the issue fundamentally is one of political will. Do our policymakers and our politicians the world over finally come to grips with the issue that we have been working with a metric that provides all kinds of perverse incentives and that we should move over to something that more correctly captures human welfare and development as opposed to just economic growth as I defined it before, as an issue of simply the scale of the economic system.
Because we know that there are people in our society who are badly off. You can look at the news and see families living in cars. We know these things. And there are governments that have acknowledged these factors as important. You think of David Cameron making the announcement in 2010, I think, that happiness would drive policy, and then leading this austerity government, or the UAE having a minister for happiness and then also having this terrible human rights record. So it seems like there's a difference between governments acknowledging these factors as important and actually incorporating them into policy frameworks, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Exactly. Very often, the easier gap to bridge is the conceptual gap, the conceptual framework. And I think our politicians, and I think the examples that you gave are very good, and there are other politicians in the world who have expressed their dissatisfaction with current metrics. But then somehow this hasn't led to a collective effort at the higher reaches of government, specifically at the United Nations, to move and amend our system of national accounts. The system of national accounts, which delivers the GDP indicators, is actually a creation of the United Nations in the 1950s. It was an attempt, especially against the background of more and more countries becoming independent and joining the United Nations, to develop an accounting framework that would actually allow us to track, some measure of economic development. But, 50, 60 years later, I think that it's time for us to go back and to essentially rethink the entire system and to change it with something that is more sensible. I think ultimately, the debate hinges on the following. I think that we all understand that, it is important for the economy to provide for basic needs in society, in housing, in food, in healthcare, and so on. But that also, I think, the economy is supposed to allow us to extend the reach of human abilities. The most important role that economics must play in development, it seems to me, lies in equipping people and institutions with the means through which they can achieve the real purpose of development, which is laying the foundations for a new social order that can cultivate the limitless potentialities latent in human consciousness. I think that is ultimately what economic development is about. It's not just about, you know, the pursuit of material satisfactions and means, but it is ultimately having to do with the development of our latent capacities. And to have a good metric of progress and welfare is very important, because then the incentives change. If we had been using, for instance, Daly and Cobb, a sustainable index of sustainable economic welfare, it's quite possible that we would have adopted policies that would have been quite different in terms of their outcomes for society. We might have made further progress earlier on in dealing with, you know, climate change and all the associated consequences.
New Zealand, as you're probably aware, has flagged a wellbeing budget in 2019, where they've identified five areas of wellbeing priority that they want to focus on. But New Zealand's government has also committed to these budget responsibility rules that require state spending to be kept at 30% of GDP. And I assume that wellbeing markers as a measure of success requires more spending. Would that be your understanding? I just wondered how hard it would be for a government that's committed to fiscal restraint on one hand and also committed to wellbeing markers driving policy on the other hand to kind of balance its books in that way.
Yeah, I think that is the challenge of good economic policy. You want to implement policies that are supportive of social development, of equity, inclusion, and so on. But at the same time, you want to do it in a framework of fiscal responsibility. And not just fiscal responsibility for the next 2 or 3 years, but actually in a medium-term framework. Let me give you an example. We have, in many parts of the world, a problem of aging populations. The economists have already highlighted that over the longer term in many of these countries, there will be an increase in the fiscal pressures and the demands on the budget, you know, for social security, for pension, for health expenditures, and so on, because a growing number of retirees will have to be supported by a shrinking base of contributors. We know that climate change and all the associated calamities that are coming our way will require some fiscal effort. We will have to spend money to support various vulnerable groups. Some countries may have to spend money to facilitate the movement of peoples who are living close to coastal areas. There will have to be resources provided to address the impact of extreme weather events, whether it is drought or hurricanes and so on and so forth. And I think this is the time, you know, to do fiscal policies that incorporate these likely pressures on the budget over the next 10, 15, 20 years. The Norwegians are doing this very well. The Swedes are doing this very well. You know, Sweden is a country that in 2008, when we had the global financial crisis, basically argued that, yes, this crisis requires some interventions. It may require some fiscal stimulus. It may require some additional spending to deal with the effects of the crisis. But this has to be framed in terms of the demands that we know will be placed on our budget in a much longer term perspective beyond this crisis. And so Sweden is one of the few countries in the European Union whose debt ratio, public debt ratio to GDP, has actually remained fairly stable throughout the crisis, whereas it has increased remarkably in most of the other members of the European Union. The Norwegians, an energy-rich country, have been stashing money away in a wealth fund where they already have more than $1 trillion. This is a country with 5 million people, and they have $1 trillion of savings, essentially, to be prepared to meet the claims on the budget associated with population aging over the next several decades. So I think that spending for more for social protection to deal with issues of equity and inequality and inclusion is fine, but it has to, those policies have to be framed in a medium-term framework, and they have to be done in a way that is sustainable, including, of course, on the budget.
I spoke to Richard Layard, the London School of Economics professor, earlier this year, whose work centres on well-being and happiness-centered policy. And he was talking about mental health care as one of the big long-term cost savers in developed countries. And that's something that New Zealand has flagged as one of those five budget priorities. But at the same time, we've just had a report that has shown how badly caught short our mental health system has been. And mm-hmm. and also the issue that even people within the sector don't agree on the best way to treat mental health. So I guess that's one of the challenges for government in 2019 is trying to reconcile all of that.
Yeah, I'm fully supportive of that. And let me just give you an example, which I think highlights how in many other parts of the world, we're not getting this trade-off, you know, right. There was a study at the IMF in 2015 looking at the cost of energy subsidies, subsidizing gasoline, natural gas, carbon, electricity, the world over. And they came up with a figure that was $5.3 trillion, which in 2015 numbers was equivalent to about 6.5% of world GDP. So these figures are astronomical. Furthermore, sort of two important conclusions of this study were that these subsidies are, of course, highly regressive. You know, 60% of the benefits go to the top 20% of the income distribution because they tend to benefit car owners, you know, the middle class and so on. And so they are making what is already a very serious problem in the world, income inequality, worse than would otherwise be the case. But furthermore, the study said that if these subsidies were eliminated altogether, it would lead to a 20% reduction in emissions of global warming gases. So here you have an example of a public policy which is worsening climate change and it is worsening income inequality, and yet it is being done all over the world. New Zealand is not part of that terrible, terrible set of public policies. But I did want to mention this example, sort of to mention that in many other parts of the world, you know, this trade-off between doing more on the social side to protect and to spend more on education and public health and so on is not a very high priority. And the trade-off is not being achieved in an efficient way.
I wanted to ask about your book, Equality for Women Equals Prosperity for All, because it flags women's empowerment as the greatest antidote to poverty. And I wondered if you had any favourite examples of where in the world you had seen policy change as a driver for reducing some of those gender equity gaps.
Yes. You know that in the book with my co-author, who's a French novelist, Bahia Nakhchivani, we looked very hard at the whole debate about quotas. You know, many countries have adopted quotas for the participation of women in parliaments, in local village councils, and so on. And we wanted to see what is the evidence, you know, does it make a difference? Can one make a case for the adoption of quotas as a way of perhaps accelerating the narrowing of the gender gap in terms of political empowerment specifically? And the data is overwhelmingly very, very positive. What we discovered, for instance, was that those countries that have quotas, the female labor force participation rate of women is much higher than in those countries that don't have the quotas. What we saw that in India, for instance, India is an interesting country. They don't have quotas at the federal level. In fact, the participation of women in the Indian parliament is very, very low. It's like 11%, which is, you know, half of the world average. But in the 1990s, the government introduced a one-third quota for women in local village councils, which are the sort of smallest administrative unit, you know, in the states. But it did so kind of optionally. The states had the choice to either introduce the quotas or not, and, you know, some did and some didn't. And what researchers did is they went and they basically did a bit of a controlled experiment that you could actually trace the impact of the introduction of the quotas in the village councils and then compare the states that had introduced them and states that hadn't. And the results were really quite enlightening and interesting. You know, in those states where women were politically empowered as a result of the quotas, what was discovered is that the structure of expenditure at the level of the village was, you know, much different. There was more money being spent on water projects, on education, on health, on those things that, you know, strengthen social cohesion, than in those village councils where the quota did not exist. And what was really interesting is that there was a survey done in the 1990s when the quotas were introduced to look at attitudes of men. And initially, their attitude was very skeptical. They were not happy, you know, with this overnight empowering of women politically at the level of the village councils. Ten years later, the same man had a degree of comfort with the participation of women that was, you know, very visible. They were voting for women because they had seen that the inclusion of women in the councils had actually led to very good results in terms of the overall welfare in the community. And therefore, this had led to a change in mentality, a change in attitudes. And this, it seems to me, is very, very important when it comes to addressing issues of gender inequality. You know, you need to change people's mental framework. And the introduction of the quotas in India had exactly that effect. So we come out very strongly in favor of quotas for the participation of women in parliament all over the world, because we think it is something that brings benefits across the board.
You were a very senior figure with Lehman Brothers International for a few years before 2003. Among those organisations notable for not really concerning itself with community well-being. And I just wondered, outside of government policy, what you thought, on the basis of your experience, could be done around some of these non-government financial institutions, whether there was any hope of shifting mindset or policy there, or whether you think government policy is the only place that we can realistically focus in terms of driving some kind of change that's beyond GDP and the accumulation of wealth.
Yeah. I think that, you know, obviously there is a role for government regulation of the financial sector in the world at large. I think that part of the problem of the crisis in 2008 and 2009 was that we had governments that were very much focused on the regulation of deposit-taking banks, but were completely oblivious to what was actually happening in what was then called the shadow banking system, you know, investment banks and all kinds of hedge funds and other organizations that were doing something that at that time was called financial innovation. And I think it was essentially this kind of very schizophrenic regulation of the overall financial system that, you know, precipitated the crisis, because we had a fairly good monitoring of what was happening with the, you know, the banks that were catering, the retail banks that were catering and taking deposits from the population, but not the other vehicles. And so one question is basically whether 10 years after the crisis, you know, governments have done enough to actually help prevent the next crisis. And here I have some concerns, because in 2008 and 2009, there were a whole range of sort of very ad hoc interventions on the part of governments and central banks, you know, to help us address, you know, the impact of the crisis. And so there was a lot of money spent to bail out the banking system. There was a lot of money spent to stimulate the economy through a relaxation of fiscal policies and so on. And I think that, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, most people would agree that it was the appropriate thing to do to intervene and to prevent the occurrence of something, you know, like the Great Depression of the late 1920s, early 1930s. However, that hasn't been free of consequences. If you actually look at what has happened in the last 10 years, is that there has been a huge increase in the burden of public debt on governments. You know, at the time of the crisis, I remember Spain was a country that had a debt-to-GDP ratio of about 37% of GDP. It was well below what then was considered by most economists to be, you know, safe levels. It was well within what was then called the Maastricht criteria in the European Union, which established a threshold of 60% as being, you know, sort of the level that was, you know, at the top. You know, you wouldn't want to have more than 60% of GDP debt levels. Well, Spain was at 37. Well, today, 10 years after the crisis, after having bailed out many of the banks, after having spent a great deal of money to address the contractionary effects of the financial crisis, Spanish debt levels are at close to 100% of GDP. And this is a huge increase over a relatively short period, a decade. The reason I worry about the next crisis is because if a crisis comes, from some exogenous shock, from some, you know, perturbation to the system, either from within the system or from without, I think governments are going to be in a much weaker position to respond to the crisis than they were in 2007. And I think this is something that we have not yet internalized in the global financial architecture that we have at present. And it is something that worries me. I guess in not so many words, you know, we have a global financial system that is fully integrated, but we don't have, for instance, a global lender of last resort as we do in national economies. And this is something that I think we need to give more thought to ahead of the next crisis, which sooner or later is likely to come.
That's Augusto Lopez Claros, a director at the World Bank, currently on a fellowship with Georgetown University and in our Auckland studio last week.